From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, it's all about the hyphen as we partner with Hyphen Magazine to look at the places where the Latino and Asian American experiences meet. We'll hear about a resource center for the undocumented, both Asian and Latino.
I just had a student yesterday. She came in and she honestly just stared at the whole place and just said, "Wow, I feel like I'm home. Like, I feel like there's a place for me here."
And a Latino-Asian perspective on affirmative action.
Asian Americans are often used as kind of a group to pit against other communities of color.
Plus, we hear what happens when sake meets salsa, and a survivor of a Japanese internment camp shares her sabiduría. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan.
Se va a dormir. Deja la tele para escuchar las últimas palabras del presentador, que dice buenas noches hasta mañana.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week, an hour on spaces and ways Latinos and Asian Americans meet. We paired up with the folks at Hyphen, a magazine that tells stories about Asian American life. And joining me now from KQED in San Francisco is Hyphen's editor-in-chief, Abigail Licott. Hey, Abby, welcome.
Hi, Maria. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to speak with you.
So let's start by you talking to us a little bit about Hyphen.
Our founders were basically sitting around a kitchen table bemoaning the demise of A Magazine, which at the time was pretty much the only outlet for Asian American voices and stories. So they decided to start another one. You start from scratch, and that's how Hyphen was born.
There have been real clear moments of collaboration where Latinos and Asian Americans have, in fact, worked together. So can you start us off with some examples?
This is exactly what's being forgotten in all the negative media hype, especially when it concerns issues like affirmative action or immigration. The longest and hardest battle, I think, has been farm worker movements throughout the 20th century. The Cesar Chavez and Larry Itliong partnership during the Delano grape strike and boycott in 1965.
The marchers want to dramatize a local labor dispute. A strike has been called against the growers of California grapes.
Cesar Chavez, just to demonstrate how very committed he was and how much he believed in it, when he was addressing the National Farm Workers Association, he straight up told everyone, "Hey, you know, I'm joining the Filipinos. If you don't like it, then you can just get out."
Of course, there's always love. You know, is it normal and typical to have a Punjabi-Mexican wedding?
Not a lot of people know about it. But in fact, in the early 20th century, there was a lot of intermarriage in the Imperial Valley in California between Punjabis, primarily Sikh men, and Mexican women.
Well, after they were here for several years, they realized that their women were not allowed to come into the country. So they seeked out to see who they could marry. And they found the Mexican women very compatible.
So the Sikh men kind of came to the U.S. to work. They were not allowed to bring wives over due to Asian Exclusion Acts. And the Mexican women were kind of displaced by the Mexican Revolution. And they just, you know, they'd fall in love and kind of build families together. And the interesting thing with that is that in doing so, they were able to circumvent land laws that didn't allow Punjabi men and other, you know, undesirable immigrants to own land.
All right. So then now, if you fast forward to, you know, just around the civil rights movement, you know, you don't immediately have images of Asians and Latinos working together, you know, in legal cases around desegregation.
Right. Well, there's the well-known Mendez versus Westminster case. A man of Mexican descent tried to enroll his kids in the so-called white schools and was denied. A lot of people jumped in to really cooperate with his counsel, his legal counsel. There was the Japanese American Citizens League, the NAACP, the Jewish American Congress. They all wrote amicus briefs in support of desegregation.
So what about the conversation now and the ways in which, in particular, you've been talking about women and working women working together on, again, labor issues like the Reynolds boycott protest? So what is the Reynolds boycott?
Well, it was launched by Asian American and Latino American factory workers who are trying to fight against sweatshop conditions. The Reynolds Company is a subsidiary of a larger company that produces containers for big box stores like Walmart and Costco. Women were going to management and saying, hey, you know, you need to stop forcing us to work overtime. You need to give us breaks. You need to give us fair pay, and you need to allow us to kind of dissent and organize. And they were all ignored, completely ignored. So I'm so glad to see that there is kind of this new renewal of solidarity.
And perhaps one of the places where the collaboration between Asian and Latinos is at least most visible among the young people is among the undocumented immigrant, the Dreamer movement. What's going on there?
I mean, there has been issues of Asians kind of being more in the closet about it, at least initially, but now they're increasingly coming out.
We will fight to end and dismantle this cruel and inhumane enforcement system that is ripping apart millions of families. Because we are one day closer to when 34,000 beds will lay empty in detention centers. And this country will awake to the realization that it is against our values to tear a dad away from his children for a mere broken taillight.
They're joining together, Latinos and Asian Americans, in these pan-ethnic collective groups. They're marching, they're holding hunger strikes, they're making thousands of phone calls to senators urging them to pass the DREAM Act. It's really exciting to see, and it's really a hopeful thing, you know, a sign of great things to come and great transformations to come.
It was clear that we had a long, long, long tradition, but that just, we don't talk about it. So I'm really glad that we were able to kind of go through the ways in which Asians and Latinos have, in fact, been collaborating. All right, Abby, well, we'll talk to you later in the show.
Okay, thanks, Maria.
That's Abigail Licod, the editor-in-chief of Hyphen Magazine, and she'll be joining us back again later in the show. Undocumented students face various obstacles to higher education. A big one is that they can't get federal financial aid, and often they can't work. For those students who do make it to college, there's the isolation of feeling like no one really understands your situation, and there's always the real fear of deportation. But the University of California, Davis, has welcomed its undocumented students, Latino, Asian, or anyone, by opening a resource center that is just for them. Emily Wilson has our story.
This space is for students to study, to get together, to have group study, to take a nap. We also have a really good couch for that.
Ana Maciel is a junior at UC Davis, majoring in Chicano studies and political science. She spearheaded the effort to make the Undocumented Student Center a reality.
I've been here throughout the whole production of, like, the walls coming up and, like, the furniture coming in. My first reaction was I got teary-eyed, to be honest. I walked in. I'm like, kind of getting teary-eyed right now.
There are around 35,000 grads and undergrads on the Davis campus. About 1 in 5 is Latino, and 2 in 5 are Asian. The campus has approximately 200 undocumented students, including Maciel. She remembers how isolated she felt her first year.
Coming here to the university, I hid my status the very first quarter. Like, I didn't tell anyone, actually, not even my roommate. Didn't tell anyone about my status. I was afraid that I was going to get judged. And after being judged, I was going to have no friends.
That's what made Maciel work with other students and faculty, so people like her could feel more at home.
And now we have a center. So I was really happy.
The place is a room off the university's main student center, with a few tables, some chairs, and couches. There are a couple of small offices where students can go for counseling and also get help with academics, financial aid, and legal questions. To have all this in one space where people know about your status means a lot, Maciel says.
I just had a student yesterday. Late afternoon, she walked in, had heard about the center a couple of days ago, but was questioning coming in or not. She came in, and she honestly just stared at the whole place and just said, wow, I feel like I'm home. Like, I feel like there's a place for me here.
California law allows undocumented students to pay in-state tuition if they graduate from high school and have lived in the state at least 3 years. Even so, they still live with a lot of uncertainty, says Andrea Gaetan, the center's director.
We do want to empower students to feel that they are supported, to know that, for example, they can go to the campus police department and report that they are being mistreated or threatened or that their rights are being violated and not have to fear for deportation because they're turning to the police for help.
And now they can also turn to the university's law school for help.
Yeah, I can start with that. So okay. I was at the center, and this was Monday, Tuesday. I think right when I got there to begin my office hours, I had a student come in, and he was interested in doing a DACA renewal. He was all prepared.
Great, that's great.
So yeah, I made an appointment with
Marcus
him.
Tang, a law school graduate, is talking about helping the students with their deferred action status, which gives them the ability to work and to have a driver's license. Tang will spend 2 days a week at the center as a legal fellow, doing consultations. His own parents immigrated from China, and seeing their struggles influenced him.
A big thing was always just feeling like we didn't belong. And I think that was more of maybe me being very conscious as a child, you know, seeing my parents try to interact with community members who didn't really understand the immigrant experience. That was always kind of difficult for me as a kid.
At the center, Tang has met with both Latino and Asian students. He says Latinos tend to come forward more, while Asians can be reluctant. But there's one thing they both share.
With students, I think something that's a common thread among any student, or any person, I should say, for that matter, who is undocumented, is that fear, you know, is that this constant feeling that your information could be reported to the government, right? And just speaking from, you know, from family experience and that kind of background, I think that it pervades, it transcends, you know, ethnic lines, whether Latino undocumented, whether Asian undocumented, that is something that's very conscious for a lot of people who are undocumented.
The center is a place where they can leave that fear behind. Although it's still very new, its future plans include a food bank and a professional clothes closet. Sophomore Jesus Flores does outreach to undocumented high school students to smooth the process of applying to college.
I want to give them what I didn't receive.
When Flores was looking at colleges, he had to search for scholarships and summer programs on Google.
I want to give them support, personal and academic support. And I also want to motivate them. I want to motivate them to not get comfortable. I really want to get them to go to a higher education. That's my main goal for now.
The center's staffers hope this holistic model will be replicated on other campuses. And that seems like it might happen. Gaetan, the director, has already gotten inquiries from other schools in California and Arizona. She hopes to do presentations around the country. For Latino USA, I'm Emily Wilson in Davis, California.
Coming up on Latino USA.
It's not in our culture to start the gang thing, but we were forced to start it to defend for ourselves, you know.
The very particular role of gangs in Cambodia Town, Long Beach, California. That's coming up.
You've got this strange control over me. Got this strange control over me. Well, there's nothing I can do, so I've decided to let you. But it's getting bad, bad, bad. I remember when I met you, all the promises I heard. The potential that I sign you.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In California, affirmative action has been banned in public universities since Prop 209 passed in 1996. But the issue still causes plenty of controversy, sometimes within communities of color. Julia Hsu has the story.
Since 1996, civil rights groups in California have fought to bring back race-conscious admissions. The last report from the University of California had whites at over a quarter of undergrads, Latinos a little below that, and Asian Americans in the biggest group, over one-third. Less than 1 in 25 students are Black. Nationally, most Asian Americans support affirmative action. Phuc Pham is a student at University of California, Irvine.
Black and Latino students aren't represented in the same amount of numbers that you see across the state.
Irvine's racial makeup is pretty similar to what I said earlier, except that at UCI, the number of Asian American students is even greater and the number of Black students lower than the average.
Two springs ago, an Asian American interest fraternity put on a promotional video for a party at the end of the year, and one of the members donned blackface.
Phuc thinks a more diverse campus might make some people think twice about racially insensitive actions. Last spring, a piece of legislation called the Senate Constitutional Amendment 5, or SCA 5, proposed a change to the state constitution that would allow race-conscious admissions. Here's Jonathan Tran from the Southeast Asian Resource and Action Center.
We were one of the first Asian American organizations to sign on into support of SCA 5 when it was introduced. One out of every three Cambodian Americans does not have a high school degree.
SCA 5 passed the California Senate when the Democrats had a supermajority. But when it went to the Assembly, three senators had been charged with criminal offenses. Suddenly, making changes to the amendment wasn't a possibility anymore. That's when SCA 5 became controversial, and a small, well-funded minority of Asian Americans mobilized against it.
Unfortunately, I think in the media coverage, it painted the Asian American community in very broad strokes to say as if there was a unified message that was opposed to affirmative action.
Much of the opposition to SCA 5 came from Chinese Americans. Posts on Twitter written in Chinese quoted Martin Luther King and called SCA 5 the Skin Color Act.
This SCA 5 happens to be in an area that I care a lot because I'm a California resident.
Dr. Haibo Huang is from the 80-20 Initiative, a political action committee, and one of the organizations that lobbied against SCA 5. To him, SCA 5 looked dangerously like the early 1900s, when elite universities intentionally decreased Jewish enrollment by changing admission criteria with so-called objective evidence.
The matter of fact is that Asian enrollment would just drop mysteriously to the level that people like.
The opposition to SCA 5 was so vocal that three Chinese-American state senators who initially voted for it withdrew their support.
This is the first time that I've ever followed the lead of Asian American civil rights organizations and then gotten blindsided. And so that's why I'm trying to be responsive to the community and trying to stop SCA 5.
All right.
That's Senator Ted Lieu speaking on Bay Voice, a Chinese radio station, and explaining why he changed his position. After that, Lieu lost six endorsements from Black and Latino legislators. To Jonathan Tran, that isn't unexpected.
Asian Americans are often used as kind of a group to pit against other communities of color. Within the Asian American community, I think it's very important that we take ownership of a voice, because the reality is that California is going to become a minority-majority state. Our seat at the table depends on our ability to work with our other communities of color.
For now, State Senator Ed Hernandez, the sponsor of SCA 5, has tabled it. He's hoping to revive it in 2016. For Latino USA, I'm Julia Hsu.
When we talk about race in this country, we far too often speak in terms of the racial binary, the social and economic gap between white and Black Americans. But race, of course, is much more than just Black and white. Latinos, Asian Americans, and other racial and ethnic groups are sort of, well, racial middles. We're not necessarily white. We're not necessarily Black. So where exactly do we fit in? Hyphen Magazine editor Abigail Licod joins us again from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome back, Abby.
Thank you.
And now joining us is also Dr. Jason Oliver Chang at WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut. He teaches both Latin American and Asian American courses for the University of Connecticut. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Connecticut is a very interesting place. One number that's interesting that we found out, there is at least one Puerto Rican in every Connecticut whatever they're called.
Hamlets.
Like hamlets, you know, there's at least one Puerto Rican in every single one, and there's like 51.
No, it's amazing. I got my PhD in California, and you kind of assemble your political sensibilities of different groups. And then I came to the East Coast, and the Latinos are different, and the Asians are different. The African Americans are different here, and it's exciting to learn about the global location of Connecticut.
The global location of Connecticut.
Yeah.
So, all right. So let's just take a moment and define this racial middle. I never actually thought of myself as a middle, but then, you know, recently I had to fill out one of those forms where it was like, what are you racially? And I was like, oh, I'm going to check all of them. I was like, what? So for you, how, and we'll start with you, Abby, define this racial middle.
Well, usually when people talk about race, they compare it to either whiteness or blackness, right? Overlooking kind of other races and the complexity of kind of other people of color. It's kind of allowing for a multiple view of race.
All right. So Jason, for you on your college campus, and you've been a professor for several years now, when you talk about the racial middle, do people on the campus understand it? Is there an active conversation around this? Or is it the same kind of like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, that's a good question. I try to articulate it for my students in terms of mechanisms and outcomes, right? Because for some of them, they think of race as having their particular kinds of mechanisms, like racial profiling, for instance, and that as Asian Americans don't experience racial profiling, so they say, well, we don't have that experience, so we don't see that kind of racism. And so I think for them, they are a little bit, you know, looking at it as an outsider because the mechanisms of racialization for Asian Americans have not been really fleshed out.
You would think that there would be a sense of like, I don't know, kind of respect, right, among Asian Americans and Latino Americans to say, God, you know, it's really cool that you are maintaining these, you know, these very specific and very, you know, identifiable things around your culture. Do they identify around that? Is there a kind of like mutual respect, like, yeah, you know, or is there more a sense of, I don't know you then?
Well, from my view, it's a bit sad, but there isn't that mutual recognition between both cultures, not to the extent that would be great to have for forging solidarity, because both cultures are so kind of diverse within the cultures. There's a lot of competition within each culture of kind of who's more advanced or who's more intelligent or refined. You know, for example, in Asian cultures, I would say that the Japanese kind of feel this, you know, I'll just say it, superiority at times because of their imperial history. That thinking within cultures of this competition, it's so mired in that it hasn't quite made it to where there's respect towards people outside the culture, because just within the culture, there are already factors.
So Jason, but would that give the opportunity, you know, for those people who say, well, what, once you come to the United States, though, we're all American. And so with each passing generation, does, you know, the homogenized Asian American, then does it become a thing that's real? You know, just like the homogenized Latino who is, you know, a little bit of everything, and then you're not really fighting amongst the groups. Is that a positive? Is that a negative?
Well, I think for people in the racial middle that we're calling it is, I think that they might view their immigrant past or their heritage as a liability to being considered American. And I think my students are very cautious about what parts of their stories they share and with who they share it. And it seems to be a kind of informal calculus of association.
Yeah, I'm thinking about how sad it makes me feel that there has to be an element of young people in college. So these are educated young people feeling that they have to be cautious about their kind of own personal narrative. I don't know. Am I wrong to feel sad about that? Should I just be like, no, that's great?
No, I think it reflects the anxiety that the middle position holds. Not that it's any less anxious to be Black, but that there's an ambiguity in the triangulation between whiteness and Blackness.
And what about the role of the media? Sometimes if you do see Asian and Latino characters, maybe it's like for young adult stuff, and race and ethnicity just and identity just doesn't come up. But is there something here that's happening in terms of how this is being told or not in mainstream media? I mean, that's why I think it's so wonderful that Hyphen and Latino USA are doing this collaboration, because even if we just start the conversation, it's got to start someplace.
Absolutely. I think there's this overexcitement about cultural fusion, for instance, like Korean taco trucks or other artistic fusions, and that those serve to kind of ameliorate concerns about this contact zone and to pitch it as more about a kind of aesthetic than having real material, political, and human sorts of consequences.
Abby, take us to the hopeful spot. Take us to the place where things turn out wonderful and we're not a post-racial America, but we are something else. What does that look like in terms of Latinos and Asian Americans?
Solidarity won't always be easy, right? I mean, that's a given. Like, historically, they're diverging agendas sometimes and strategies. But I think if we put our minds to recognizing commonalities more, that we really have the potential as two groups to create kind of a third space in terms of thinking of race, right? Where we're not in this dichotomous place of either or. We can kind of continue to see race through multiple lenses and kind of adopt this multicultural, even international kind of attitude. So I think that it's possible to still recognize racial hierarchy and racial difference. But through that, I believe very much that people we need to try, you know, which is why I'm excited about the collaboration, because I think it's an excellent way to try and to begin.
Trying is good. We're glad. Trying is good. Yeah. Thanks, Abby. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maria.
If I describe this next story, you're going to think you heard it on our air. But, of course, there's a twist. The story would go like this. Refugees are coming here, escaping civil war. They settle into abandoned and poor neighborhoods. Their kids drop out of school and end up joining deadly gangs inside and outside of prison. But this story isn't about Central Americans. It's about Asian Americans in California. Our producer, Camilo Vargas, has more.
If you look inside my eyes, you probably think my life is simple. But guarantee you'll be surprised from all the shit that I done been through.
Alex Pham lives in Long Beach, California. His rapper name is Stupid Young. That's stupid with a dollar sign. Alex is Cambodian-American.
When we came to Long Beach, the Hispanics was picking on the Asians, so the Blacks would help us out. Our type of style, like our gang lingo, and like we adapted to like a lot of, because they helped us out.
Long Beach, where Alex grew up, is a city about 20 miles south of Los Angeles. It's home to the largest Cambodian population in the U.S., but the Mexican-American gangs that were already there didn't welcome them into their turf.
It's not in our culture to start the gang thing, but we were forced to start it to defend for ourselves, you know.
That's Ricky Muth, Alex's dad. Ricky was a child in the 70s, back when Cambodia was ruled by the brutal communist dictator Pol Pot and his Khmer Rouge regime. Millions of Cambodians were worked to death and massacred in the Khmer Rouge's killing fields. Ricky escaped with his family.
So I remember most of that during the war, crossing to the jungle on foot, trying to get to Thailand, and during the Khmer Rouge War, seeing people blowing up in front of you as a little kid, you know, so people getting killed, getting shot in front of us, bloodied body everywhere.
Ricky's family settled in a working-class neighborhood in Long Beach. Most refugees came with little schooling and were still reeling from the trauma of war. Ricky dropped out of school like many Cambodian, Vietnamese, and Laotian kids. They formed newer gangs like the Asian Boys to stand up to the Mexican gangs like the East Side Longos.
Los sospechosos
un grupo de jóvenes camboyanos.
Van Nuys' clique of the Asian Boys gang that is responsible for a mid-1990s bloodbath that left...
Put your hands where I can see them.
In 1989, the killing of an East Side Longo by an Asian gang started a cascade of drive-by shootings and vendettas. An estimated 800 Asians were at war with 4,000 Latinos, and that lasted through the 90s.
We survived the killing field through all the war, through all the savagery. No, so we got to stand up for ourselves over here, too.
Ricky's son, Alex, was born at the height of the gang war. His father went in and out of prison. His mom was unemployed. So Alex's grandmother raised him. But Alex soon followed in Ricky's footsteps. He eventually joined the Asian Boys gang.
I got incarcerated before I even joined the gang. And me, I didn't get to finish high school, unfortunately, because I started getting incarcerated at a young age before high school was even over.
Despite this idea that all Asian Americans are getting college degrees, they're attending the best colleges, they're going on to grad school and becoming successful. We see about half of Southeast Asians have not completed high school.
That's Robert Teranishi, a leading education researcher at UCLA and NYU. He says kids like Alex bust the myth that all Asian Americans are what some sociologists call the model minority.
These are groups that do not have a similar history in America as other Asian American groups. Their whole point of origin in America comes from war, comes from their experience as refugees.
In fact, Cambodians finish high school almost at the same rate as Latinos. And that's not all they have in common.
A lot of these kids don't understand why they exist today. You know, they don't know their own history.
That's Peter Lai. He's a math teacher and a former gang member himself. He mentors in a Long Beach school program called the Male Academy.
One of the projects we have is for each kid to find his family history. And in the end, they have to interview another person of a different culture and learn about their culture.
Came in this game with everybody doubting me. But in the end, those same people know they're proud of me. Love and hate at the same time as jealousy.
Everything changed when I found out I had talent and I could use it. And like other people that wasn't Asian enjoyed it, like blacks, Hispanics. You actually could do something with it.
When Alex was incarcerated at 18, a nonprofit that takes music to kids in prison inspired Alex to start rapping. He left gang life behind. His life now revolves around music.
Broken roots, I never forget where I came from the crooked cops to the gunshots.
What I notice is that, like, a lot of people who's incarcerated, no matter which race, they all have, like, some type of similarity in the same childhood. It was just kind of like a lifestyle that we were just born into.
Gang violence in Long Beach is down to a 40-year low. Gangs still recruit young members, especially among kids who have family in gangs. But Alex's family broke that cycle.
Dedication to this music, ain't no moving backwards.
Alex's father, Ricky, also retired from gangs. He has a full-time job, and this is Ricky's advice to his own grandchildren.
What we've been through, we don't want them to go through it. We put our feet down for them, we're ready to walk the street, so, you know, there's no need for them to gang, but just, you know, they need to focus on their future, education, school.
For Latino USA, I'm Camilo Vargas.
On our PBS and World Channel TV show, America by the Numbers, with Maria Hinojosa, we go deep into the Cambodian-American dropout crisis in Long Beach, California. For more information about the TV series, go to americabythenumbers.org and let us know what you think. Coming up on Latino USA...
It was the psychological damage that was done to us that was really the most profound effect.
A survivor of the Japanese-American internment. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Aren't you down going nowhere, no place left at? Aren't you down going nowhere, time ain't on your side? Walls come down, ends up, drop down, know just what I find. Walls come down, ends up, drop down, no place left to hide. So I go around, feeling so brand new. Slip out sideways, getting far from you. I go around, round, feeling so brand new. And I've given up on giving in to you. Hunt you down, go. Hunt you down, going nowhere, time ain't on your side. Walls come down, ends up, drop down, know just what I find. Walls come down, ends up, drop down, no place left to hide.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I'm bringing back Abby Lee Cad again to chat about one of my favorite Asian-Latino intersections. Of course, we have to talk about food.
You know, it's funny because it's really trendy now. Being Filipino myself and kind of always having felt an affinity with Mexicans and other Latinos because of the history of Spanish colonization, we already have similar dishes in common. So it's not new to me, you know? Like, we have menudo, we have leche flan, that's my favorite.
Oh, leche flan.
I really love sweets.
Leche flan.
Leche flan.
That's
okay.
So cute. So that's like, yeah, what? That's like flan or tres leches?
No, it's like flan. Ah. It's like the same, basically, you know? Except my mom makes it super sweet because I like it super sweet. Yeah, so we've always had these kind of shared dishes. But so it's funny to me how, like, oh, it's so trendy and all this kind of stuff. Because to me, you know, I grew up kind of moving between households of my friends who were Latino and my family. And there was always kind of the reassuring presence of pork, pork, and more pork. You know, that's what's showing up in all these Chino-Latino foods as well. There's a lot of, you know, pork dishes. In a way, it's great because, you know, it's kind of something new for a lot of people and it's good to experience new things and kind of reach out and make those connections. But on the other hand, it might have a tendency of kind of oversimplifying things, right? Kind of making it look on the surface that, you know, we're all getting along, but not really kind of addressing the deeper issues that are behind that.
Even in the foodie movement, isn't it about really understanding complexities about what we're bringing to the food as opposed to just putting it all together and seeing how it tastes?
No, I think the food movement is exactly about combining kind of different elements, right, and making it your own, right? So, you know, instead of just traditionally repeating culture and repeating dishes as they've been cooked, you add your own elements, and so it evolves.
Well, Abby, it's been great having you on Latino USA. Let's do this again, huh?
Likewise, yeah, thanks. I can't wait to do it again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Abby. Abigail Licat is the editor-in-chief of Hyphen Magazine. She joined us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. So, in Japan, salsa dancing is all the rage, by the way. They even have their own Salsa Congress. The salsa clubs there serve as a source of interaction and cultural mingling between the native Japanese and Latin American immigrants to Japan, and Latino immigrants as well. But Japanese salsa lovers in New York are also thriving. Carlos Koenig is a salsa instructor originally from Chile who lives in New York City. Among his students are a number of devoted Japanese salsa lovers. Here's Carlos Koenig talking about this cross-cultural form of the love of Latin music.
It's something similar between the Japanese culture and Chilean or Latin culture. We both enjoy life, like to party a lot. The Japanese culture came to me, I would say, by accident. And I think we had a chemistry with Japanese people. I'm very specific when I teach something, very detailed. And I like to correct people, and they love that. They feel that they are learning. When they like something, they become very interested, and they try to do it 100 or 200%. They are very devoted to you. In any field, there's a lot of respect for somebody that is in a position of giving some knowledge. So even I have now a few students that are teachers, and they're always going to look at me as the sensei. And that's a beautiful thing, I think. The respect to the teacher and to the, you know, material that you're giving to. Nora was a very popular singer in the 90s with Orquesta de la Luz. like kind of the biggest Japanese. And then when I was learning how to dance, she was very, very popular. Salsa singers usually in Japan, they sing in Spanish. Sake to Salsa, it was called. They loved it. It was an event where there's a diva now called Yoko, la japonesa salsera. She was playing with her orchestra. I was teaching a lesson before, and then we did a number together, and people had the chance to try different sakes and at the same time dance salsa and learn a little bit of the salsa. It was a beautiful event, and hopefully we're going to do it again. You give people something to their lives that is positive first, and it changed for some people. It changed their life for like incredible. Recently, they celebrate me my 20 years of teaching as a surprise. I realized, you know, people met in my salsa class, they got married, they have children, some of them. It creates life. That's a joy for me. There's an expression that they say, "Ishi no ue ni mo sannen." Little by little, you had to be patient and things will come to you. Ishi no ue ni mo sannen.
What does the eye of a Japanese-Mexican artist from California look like? Artist Shizu Saldamando depicts intimate moments, sometimes using a pen, sometimes on wood or cloth, to draw portraits of her friends who are out dancing or relaxing in organic Asian Latino spaces. She talks now about her work.
Born and raised, I was born in San Francisco General, and I lived there until I was 18 when I got into UCLA and moved down to LA. The Mission is so much more urban in terms of cultural influence, I think, like, than my experience in LA. It's changed a lot. Growing up in the 90s when I went to high school, it was difficult. It was an inner city. There was a lot of gang violence. It was awesome, too, because it was very diverse in a lot of ways. I think in Los Angeles, we take for granted that everybody is somehow this one Chicano or Mexican-American identity if you're Latino. And in the Mission, there was such a huge Central American population there. It was really easy to interact with different cultures and different backgrounds just by taking the bus in the morning. My dad was born and raised in Nogales, Arizona, and my mother was born in Chicago right after the Japanese-American internment camps. So her family left Roar, Arkansas, where the camp was, and had to move to the Midwest. My dad was actually a pro bono lawyer for Catholic Charities during the 80s, during all the Central American wars that were happening. My mom was a community organizer. She organized around nuclear disarmament in the 80s. People always want to know how my parents met. Like, it's somehow strange that a Mexican-American and a Japanese-American would come together. For them, in their own personal relationship, they've come together out of this really huge commitment to social justice and political activism. I think I've always gravitated towards drawing as a first thing. Maybe it's going to work with my mom when I was little and drawing in a corner. So it's always been sort of the immediacy of pen or pencil to paper. My work tries to find the ways in which everyday living is somehow revolutionary or somehow politically radical. Moving to LA, attending UCLA, was a crazy culture shock. Having to relate to a completely different set of friends, it was also, to me, just a really great time. Being in college and being having this luxury of having pools and gyms and cafeterias to eat at. It was really amazing. At the same time, it was a little bit difficult relating to people because there wasn't a lot of diversity within the art programs, and there usually isn't. All my work is based off photos that I take, pretty much. I kind of take a lot of time and meticulously render the person that's depicted in the photo. As I guess it becomes like an homage piece. A photo is just so easy to take and consume, and painting or drawing is somehow a little bit less exploitative. I depict a lot of my friends, close friends that I hang out with, that I party with. A lot of the time, going to clubs is an excuse for me to bring my camera and get some work done. Just kind of documenting what the vibe was like and what my friends were doing and how comfortable we felt within this context, or kind of showing how people can create your own scene and your own subculture. Being a biracial, I guess for lack of a better term, artist, I get asked a lot about this tension, or how is my work influenced by these two binary cultures or two opposing cultures that are so different from each other. And that's sort of like the question, that the cliche question I'm always asked. And that's, you know, it's a fair question. I just wish it was asked across the board to everybody equally. Everybody's life and background make up their work. It's just minority artists are sort of seen as that's all their work is about. And it just becomes a little bit flattening in a way. Like, so the artwork doesn't get read in very complex ways. My boyfriend was like, well, that's a good question I would want to know. And I was like, yeah, but he's from Hawaii and he makes motorcycles. So I'm like, well, do people ask you, how does your motorcycle building, how is that influenced by being from Hawaii? Do you make a poo-poo platter before you start the build, or do you do a hula dance during your welding? Like, that's the analogy I have to explain to people, how ridiculous sometimes it is. They feel like I have a story to tell. It's kind of a very, like, narcissistic thing when you think about it, how lucky I am that I would create something and someone might want to see it and put it up and talk about it. I feel really lucky that I'm able to do that.
And now, mis queridos listeners, for today's sabiduría, or words of wisdom, we hear from Marge Taniwaki. When Marge was just 7 months old, she and her family were sent to live in a California prison called Manzanar. This was during the period of Japanese-American internment. Marge takes every opportunity she can to talk about the internment experience and share her story.
The imprisonment impacted my life severely. It colored everything that happened afterward. I entered the camp at 7 months of age and stayed there until I was four. And milk was provided to the children only up to the age of two. So therefore, I lacked the calcium that any growing child needs. And I have very bowed legs and have always had dental problems. It was the psychological damage that was done to us that was really the most profound effect. We really came to hate ourselves and were looking for approval. It's always been a difficult thing to try and feel that I belonged or fit in, which is why I believe that I strove to be popular in high school. And it was a case of never having that confidence that I saw in other people. And that was because I knew what my background was. I had been in prison for no other reason than my ethnicity. And at the time that I was going to school, I really didn't know the true reasons why I and my family had been imprisoned, along with 120,000 other Americans of Japanese ancestry. The way that I coped with it was to try and look outward. And actually, it was around the time when women's liberation was coming into the fore. So I joined a group of other like-minded women, and we strove to share our fears and concerns and our triumphs as well. So I wanted to make a difference, to contribute to my community, to be able to help other people find the truth about what had happened to us. And then, of course, try and make sure that that horrendous event never happened to any other segment of our population. Putting away a particular segment of the population, the idea of it still exists today. After 9/11, it was very apparent with the arrest of several thousand Muslims here in the United States that that could have been a real possibility. Everything is given a euphemism. So they called what they did to us, putting us into relocation centers, when in fact they were prisons. So we have to call things what they are. We have to understand how the process works. We must learn each other's histories, because if we don't know it, if we don't study it, then all of that is used against it. It's the divide and conquer theory.
That's it for this week on Latino USA, but I'll see you online and on the air on PBS and on the World Channel on America by the Numbers with Maria Hinojosa. Check out AmericaByTheNumbers.org to learn more about our stories that we're telling about the changing face of the United States. And be sure to check your local PBS listings for airtimes. And most important, let us know what you think about America by the Numbers with Maria Hinojosa. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Julia Shu and Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks this week to KUCI at UC Irvine and to the folks at Hyphen Magazine, especially Editor-in-Chief Abby Lee Cadd. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And hasta la próxima. See you again next time.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security. At carnegie.org.
Of course, Morrissey.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. This is NPR.